In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums.
C-R-I-M-E-W-A-V. You're rolling with the Crime Wave, the internet's first and only podcast devoted to the crime short story. I'm Seth Harwood, your host, the first name in crime podcast fiction, and I'm ready to bring you this week's story. The Crime Wave is produced by Mystery Dog, Aldo Calcagno, and it is not safe for your minivans. That means it might contain swearing, violence, and all types of shit.
Beer by David Price. First published on Darkness Before the Dawn, February 2nd, 2009. It's a beautiful day in July here in San Diego. I took off work at noon and headed east on Interstate 8. I live in a little A-frame situated on a bluff in a rural community about 30 miles from the coast. It's a small two-story, but there's enough room for what I want: quiet and privacy. I make my living pushing paper. The physical part of me needs an outlet, so I feed it with rigorous workouts that are the core of my peace of mind. Many years ago, I wrestled and played football. I didn't set the world on fire, but I could hold my own. I loved the challenge of man against man. Even when I lost, my opponent knew damn well he had been in a fight, and I didn't lose many. That was some 20 years ago. I still have the bull neck and the beauty of a cauliflower ear. I've trimmed down to 225 pounds on my 6'1" frame. Except for the telltale signs mentioned, I'm just a white-collared guy without the pencil neck. To satisfy my aggressive side, I work out a little dojo run by a Brazilian who specializes in jiu-jitsu. I learned a few joint locks to go with my wrestling skills. When we freestyle, I work hard and always choose the youngest and biggest stud in the class. He thinks he's going to have a walkover, but it usually ends up that he taps out when I go for the kill. I put more than a few guys out with injuries. I'm giving you all this background so you'll know what I bring to the table when you mess with me. So here I am, heading home at noon, looking forward to hitting the weights in my home gym. I've got a little Rolling Stones going on the CD, and I'm feeling no pain. In my rearview mirror, I pick up a vehicle cutting across several lanes behind me. You know how you pick up something that happens at a speed faster than everything else going around you? I check my passenger side window to see a Jeep in the lane next to me riding close to my blind spot. Looks like at least two people in the front seat. I slow, but the Jeep keeps pace with me, not falling back or advancing. We go on a few miles like that, and I go back to my daydreaming as I move past the densely populated community east of San Diego. The four-lane freeway narrows to three. All of a sudden, the Jeep pulls alongside me. When it doesn't move past, I look over. In the Jeep are three guys, probably in their early 20s. They are all looking at me and laughing and pointing. I stare at them, and it seems to incite them more. They're in a Jeep with roll bars and no top, with the windows down. They're probably heading to the desert for some off-roading. Then they all flip me off. They continue to pace me side by side, laughing like hyenas the whole time. They're all drinking beers. The guy in the backseat is literally jumping up and down in his seat and waving his arms like a crazy man. Now I'm getting pissed. The way they're driving, there's going to be an accident, and at 75 miles an hour, that will result in a multi-car pileup. Don't even look to be wearing seatbelts. If they pile up, they're going airborne. I try and back off the speed to get them to go past me in hopes that they'll settle down. They pull slightly ahead. I'm still driving and keeping these fools in sight. The guy in the backseat suddenly throws a full can of beer at my windshield. I know it's full from the sound it makes as it misses and hits my fender with a thud. I can't really stop as the traffic is pretty heavy, and I'll get rear-ended for sure. I slow as they pull ahead, laughing and jumping around in their seats. My heart is racing. Now I'm seeing red, but I don't have many options. My cell is in my briefcase in the trunk. I don't want to encourage their antics, but I want their license plate number so I can call it in later. I accelerate to try and close on them so I can get a good read of the plate. Instead of trying to outrun me, they slow. I move up to about three car lengths of open space behind them and try to memorize the number. They slow even more, and as I creep up on them, the front passenger and the guy in the rear each launches beers at me. One hits my hood and bounces over the top. The other hits the road on my right and bounces into the windshield of the car to the right. I see the car swerve across my lane and go off the embankment and disappear. Then I see a plume of smoke in my rearview mirror. These assholes have played their hand. Time for me to call. For all I know, someone in that car went off the freeway is badly injured or dead. These fuckers are gonna pay now. I stay on their tail, but back 10 car lengths. Soon as we come to relatively open country, the traffic gets thinned considerably. Two more beers hit the road in front of me, but bounce away harmlessly. I continue to pace them for a couple more miles when they suddenly veer across the next lane and exit at an off-ramp. I'm far enough back to follow their move. They pull up at the stop sign at the freeway underpass. The crossroad is a rural road and there are no cars or businesses at this turnoff. They all jump out and are laughing and staring at me as I approach. I pull to a stop 7 or 8 car lengths back. They start towards me with one guy coming to my side and the two others heading to the passenger side. I open my door just enough to clear the lock, but not enough for them to notice. I'm a guy who likes to be prepared. I don't carry a knife or a gun, but I keep 2 items in my car in case I'm ever jumped or followed. Behind the passenger seat, I keep an old-fashioned anti-theft device that is no longer popular. It's a 2-parter. A metal sleeve with a cane-type hook to loop under the brake pedal, and another hook that loops over the low point of the steering wheel. One goes into the other and it locks at the tightest point. I never use the lock, but it's the best way to carry a 2-foot metal rod with a curved handle that can't be labeled a billy club. Also behind the seat, I keep a pair of 1-pound hand weights, the kinds that are used by walkers for some aerobic arm work. These are iron covered with some type of sprayed-on rubberized coating for gripability. The beauty of these is that there is a metal piece in the half circle from end to end. I guess that's supposed to make them easier to hold on to. I've never used them, ever. I'm no walker. They are, however, a legal pair of brass knuckles that are about to get their first workout. I reach back and pull 1 piece of my lock and 1 hand weight onto the front passenger seat. Then I power down the window as I'm going to talk to the guy approaching my car. Man, my heart is racing and my adrenaline is pumping. I feel like it's kickoff time and I'm about to run downfield and break the wedge. It's all I can do to control myself. I'm almost laughing, I feel so good. I just sit there and wait for them to close. Come on, chumps, come up to the window. I wait. The driver approaches on my side and bends down to talk some shit. Soon as he lowers his head, I use my arm to flip the door open. The top of the door hits him right in the eyebrow and splits him open real good. I use all my weight to open the door wide. He becomes my flipper and he's my pinball. He flies back a couple of feet. His eyebrow is gushing. I slide out quick with the club in my left hand and the knuckles in my right. The other two are coming around the car after they see their buddy get hit by the door. The guy holding his eye yells, "Get him!" For his kind words, I snap kick him right to the chin. Never hang your tongue out when you're in a fight. He'll learn this as he bites halfway through his and his mouth fills with blood. The guy coming around the back of my car gets a hard backhand with a steel club right to the larynx. Now, I've been hitting the old Adam's apple and it hurts like hell. It can debilitate you as you choke and gasp for breath. You feel like you're drowning. I get him good. He doubles over and falls to his knees. The guy coming around the front sees all this, and his eyes tell me he wishes to hell that he was somewhere else, but it's too late. His forward momentum is bringing him right to me. I face him with both tools at the ready. He tries a roundhouse right that I block with the club. I punch straight and hard with 12 to 16 inch punch to the center face with the knuckles. It's a punch like when you punch the buttons on those battling robot toys. No wasted effort, just a straight piston shot. They say Jack Dempsey's best punch was a straight right hand and he didn't wear an iron glove. I can hear the guy's teeth snap off and his nasal septum collapse. He screams and grabs his face. Now they're all incapacitated, but it ain't over for me. They're going to remember this forever. I go back to the first guy and swing my club on his shins and it cracks. He falls face first as I come around and hammer fist him in the kidneys, with 3 hard shots breaking a couple of ribs in the process. The choking guy can barely move and just waves his hands at me in a no-mas gesture. You should have thought of that before you started this shit. I kick him hard in the nuts. He'll be walking cowboy style for at least a month. The last guy with the broken teeth is trying to back away to the Jeep. I sprint to him with ease and swing my club in a sweeping arc to the side of his head. He never saw it coming. He goes down hard. That metal plate he'll soon be sporting will be sending off metal detectors at airports for the rest of his life. He was the asshole in the back seat doing most of the throwing. I drag him to the curb and place his throwing hand on the edge. Then I mash his fingers with repeated heel strikes. That should put an end to his throwing days for a long time. I walk over to the Jeep and look inside. I see an open cooler of ice and 1 can of beer left. I reach in, grab it, and pop the top. There's nothing quite like a cold beer on a hot afternoon to welcome the weekend. Requiem of Wind and Rain by James C. Clair. First published in Darkness Before the Dawn, July 15, 2008. Thunder and lightning storms are rare on Oahu. The temperature seldom varies enough or quickly enough to create the conditions that produces them. When they do occasionally occur, they tend to be prodigious. Those visiting for only a few days often fail to recognize the special nature of such storms. They're too concerned to make every moment of sun, sand, and surf count. And who can blame them? A thunderstorm is disruptive, intrusive, and an annoyance. And hey, they complain, we get weather like this at home. We came to Hawaii for the sun. Those who have lived in the islands for even a short while, on the other hand, tend to revel in the sudden downpour and the loud crack of thunder that reverberates as it rides the trades. Most to be savored, however, is the jagged bolt of lightning that reilluminates, however briefly, the usually azure skies that have gone unaccustomedly black. It was late afternoon one such storm that a middle-aged man stood on his lanai in t-shirt, shorts, and sandals and watched a display of light and sound wash violently over the streets and buildings of Waikiki. From his vantage on the 11th floor of his building, the man had, given the congestion of high-rise in the area, a remarkably clear view in three directions. The Alawai Canal, off to his right, and the mountains that rose above and beyond its inky waters were lost in the wall of rain. In front of him and just below, the tops of the palm trees that grew in the yards and along the sidewalk shook like mad dogs shedding water after a swim. The usually dry rustle of their fronds had been replaced by the sound of a swarm of hungry locusts. When he turned to the left, he could just make out the wan lights from the upper floors of the hotels and condos along Kehoe, and just beyond that, the Kalawana Avenue. The entire scene reminded him of something from the palette of a Dadaist or surreal painter. The elemental force of the storm, fearsome and beautiful at the same time, had distracted him from his reading. Reading, that's what he spent most of his time doing these days. His preference, not surprising given his background, tended towards noir. And that's not to say he ignored titles of more literary nature. He had recently acquired a taste for Conrad Green and Borges, though the latter in particular tended to be frustratingly dense and elusive. The man did, however, have a great sense of empathy for many of the Argentinian characters, the knife fighters and the rogues, the solitary gauchos, and even the ascetic and mystics. In fact, apart from his growing collection of books and the wine he drank somewhat too appreciatively, the man led what many might consider an ascetic existence, and it was most certainly solitary. In any event, it was a far cry from his former extravagant, even prolific lifestyle. True, he still went out two or three times a week for dinner. There was a little place just around the corner in the basement of the old Outrigger East on Kanakapali that he liked. The dark interior suited both his moods most night as well as the purpose of remaining more or less inconspicuous. The place also featured a jazz combo in the evening and the often bluesy, always melancholy piano, backed by bass and drums, seemed to be the perfect soundtrack to this phase of his life and career. Apart from that and the occasional walk along the canal at sunset, he seldom left his apartment. He avoided the beaches, a mere three blocks away to the south, entirely. The narrow strip of sand that ran the length of Waikiki was always crowded, and so the risk of being recognized was just too great. As he leaned against the railing of his lanai, the wind and rain lashing his face, he reflected on how even the most beautiful of places can be prisons. Indeed, the walls of his apartment might just as well have been made of bars and the doors constructed of steel. When he stole the money, he hadn't anticipated this, though he should have. He had certainly been around long enough to see what happens to most people on the run. He had even been involved in tracking down more than a few of them himself. That had been part of the problem. After all, he thought he knew all the angles, all the right moves. He had been seduced by his position and experience into thinking that he'd be the one to finally beat the house. But no one ever really beat the house. Oh, he had been ahead of the game for a time. It was a week or so before Mr. Toscano and his people even realized that the money was gone. And then another couple of days before they zeroed in on who must have taken it. The man liked to think that old Mr. T, his mentor and almost a father figure, must have been in such a state of shock when he discovered the truth that he took yet another couple of days before giving the recovery and termination orders. The man had taken full advantage of the delay. He fled first to South America, then back to the States, and finally to Hawaii, the most remote island chain in the world. He had been here for almost 18 months. He had changed his habits, his hairstyle, and his routine. But in the end, he knew that none of that would be enough. He was under sentence, on death row, and sooner now rather than later, all his appeals would be denied and his time would be up. Karma might be slow, but she was a bitch who held a grudge, and she was inexorable, unrelenting. You could run, but ultimately it was impossible to escape the consequences of your action. The man noticed that it was even darker now than it had been 5 minutes or so ago. The rain had let up a bit, but the thunder and lightning continued with increased frequency. He knew little of anything about meteorology, but he guessed that the front was passing and that what he was now witnessing were its death throes. He perceived that the freakish weather was in some way portentous, and he strained to read its arcane message. From where he stood, he could smell the ocean, and there was even a salty tang to the rain that trickled from his hair, ran down his cheeks and into his mouth. Its taste and feel reminded him of tears. Hawaii was a place that he secretly had always wanted to visit. It was amazing, really, that he really actually never done so. But then, this was territory that the Asians and the Russians had basically staked out as their own now. Not even Mr. Toscano, who was as tough and ruthless as they came, would dare to trespass on their turf. It would have been bad business, not to mention suicide. The man had traveled extensively, of course, but the organization's business had taken him to South America primarily, and as far as leisure was concerned, the Caribbean had been his beat. But he was in the land of Aloha now, a decision that had strategic value as well, since the man assumed that this would be among the last places his former associate would think to look for him. Over the past year and a half, he had fallen in love with the place. The crowds and the rampant commercialism all around him even had a certain appeal. He may not be able to articulate what he felt precisely. Not even all of his readings of late could supply him with the necessary words or images, but he sensed at some level that this was a land both ancient and at the same time as young and chaotic and innocent as the first morning of creation. The storm he was watching, for example, was something both primordial and apocalyptic about it, simultaneously. The money he had absconded with, of course, had made it possible for the man to live La Vida Loca had he chosen to do so, but that would have been a huge mistake. The goal was to blend in, to attract as little attention as possible. Also, truth be told, the man actually felt more than a twinge of guilt when he thought of how he had betrayed Mr. Toscano's confidence. It had not been mere cupidity that had motivated his actions, though greed had certainly been a part of the equation. The man had been resentful. He had worked for Toscano for close to a decade, and slowly, imperceptibly, he came to realize that despite his status as one of Mr. T's most trusted go-to guys, there was no chance for further advancement, and thus, not much of a future. When all was said and done, it was a family business after all, and man was not family. As far as retirement was concerned, well, in his line of work, there was no such thing. The man knew from the outset what happened to members of the organization once they had outlived their usefulness. Still, the man had been respected and treated well. He knew the rules, the code, the proprieties, and he had broken them all. He had betrayed his boss, and deep down he understood that to be the only truly unforgivable sin. He had toyed with the idea of sending what was left of the money, a not an insurmountable sum, back. He knew it wouldn't change the outcome, but it might have allowed him to reclaim some sense of integrity. He rejected that as an option. It would have only been construed as a sign of weakness. So, too, would simply going back in order to face the music. What was done, and the drama had to be played out now according to its foreordained script. The man settled for making sizable donations to a number of local charities and foundations. He had done so on the condition of anonymity, of course. But he still felt that such transactions could be used in some unfathomable way to track him. He recalled the computer whiz kids Toscano employed to monitor the activity of various accounts and to keep tabs on disbursements. Computers were a mystery to him, and he was reluctant even to use the internet, though he did so nonetheless, and despite the risk, real or imagined. It wasn't that the man was paranoid, though he certainly had reason to be, or that he was a coward. No one who was could have lasted as long as he had in this business. But as the weeks and months wore on, he became more convinced of the inevitability of his discovery. A less imaginative or less sensitive man in the same situation might have reckoned that his chances of getting away with it actually increased with each day that passed. This man, however, awoke each morning even more certain of his eventual demise. The situation he knew was intolerable. He had begun dreaming about, and not long after, wakefully, willfully, imagining his apprehension. In his mind's eye, he'd be sitting in his chair reading. He'd look up to find two burly guys, sometimes he'd recognize them, most times not, standing in front of him leveling pistols at his chest. There were even times when he would picture old man Toscano himself standing over him while he lay in bed. In those instances, Mr. T's weapon of choice was usually a pillow. Unseen hands would hold the man down while his former boss did what he had come to do. The man understood that reality seldom corresponded to one's expectations for it. Still, his fantasies, in some sense, helped steel him against that day when one of them materialized in earnest. Although his lanai was covered by a concrete roof that served as a deck of the porch in the unit above his own, the sides and the front were open to the elements, save for a waist-high railing shaped like a half-moon which enclosed the structure. As hot as he normally was here, the man found himself chilled by the ferocious breeze that was blowing, and he suddenly realized that his shirt and his shorts were soaking wet. As he turned to go into his darkened apartment, a lightning bolt flashed overhead and illuminated the interior. Standing in the middle of the living room were two men. Shit, he thought. How typical. I must have forgotten to lock the door when I came in. Not that anyone would have heard them breaking down the door and all the noise produced by the storm. Even though their faces were illuminated for only a second, he knew he had never seen either one of them before. He wasn't surprised. Mr. Toscano was an efficient, practical man. It would have been far more expeditious to hire a local talent. That apparently is just what he had done. Both of his assailants carried weapons and both had dark complexions. Certainly no shock in this climate. One of the two looked Asian, maybe Filipino. The other almost was certainly Colombian. The man realized then that there was no negotiation and almost certainly no conversation. He stopped in his tracks and looked around. He wasn't frightened. In fact, if he felt anything at all, it was relief. He walked back to the railing and looked out at the storm that was clearly now beginning to abate. For an instant, he considered jumping. But that had never figured into any of the scenarios he'd imagined. Instead, he closed his eyes and pictured the scene in his mind. In doing so, he distanced himself from the harsh reality, and in the process, the whole episode came to resemble nothing more than one of the many daydreams he had had entertaining for months now about this very moment. The man almost laughed out loud. He paid no attention whatsoever when the two hired guns, startled when the man turned and headed back out onto the lanai, but somewhat more relaxed when they realized he was absolutely nowhere to run, moved in close behind him. The man didn't feel it when one of the two intruders placed his weapon at the base of his head where his neck and shoulders met. If he heard anything when the trigger was pulled, it sounded to him just like another clap of thunder. The man didn't jump, but much to the consternation of his assailants, his body did pitch forward and tumble from the lanai. It sailed through the wind and rain and hit the sidewalk below with a thud that was just audible above the din of the dying storm. There was so much water running on the street and over the walkways that the man's blood never had a chance to pool. It washed away instantly into the storm drain and eventually merged with the warm, amniotic waters of the Pacific. The two gunmen left the apartment and calmly but deliberately made their way down the stairs that zigzagged outside the building at the rear. By the time they reached the street, the rain had stopped and the sun was beginning to poke through the clouds. The lingering scent of ozone was as strong as, too, were the rain-washed fragrances of ginger and plumeria. The Filipino stopped when he felt his cell phone vibrate in his pocket. "Yeah, it's done," he said in Tagalog when he answered. "What? You've got to be kidding me. Shit, what do you want us to do now?" "Listen, this isn't our fault." "Okay, right away." The man's partner, who was indeed Colombian, couldn't understand a word of what was being said in the gibberish everyone around here spoke, but he could sense that something was wrong. He stared at the Filipino man with a questioning look in his eyes. The Filipino closed his phone and stuffed it back into his pocket. "Listen, Carlos, you dumb shit," he barked in surprisingly passable Spanish. "We really screwed up. We whacked the wrong guy. They were supposed to have sent us the 11th floor of a building on Kanakapali, not Liokolani, like they said. Damn Hawaiian names all sound the same anyhow. How the hell were we supposed to know the difference? Mr. Ono wants us back right away so we can figure out what to do next. Somebody's going to have to pay for this, but it's not going to be us. Son of a bitch, did you see that idiot up there anyway? He acted like he knew we were coming, almost like he expected, even wanted, it to happen. I swear, as long as I live, I'll never understand people. Let's get the hell out of here." They got into their cars and pulled away. They could hear the Doppler sounds of sirens as the police and fire rescues began to arrive. And now a piece of flash fiction from PowderburnFlash.com. Bitch by Cormac Brown. Published in Powderburn Flash, January 2nd, 2009. I can't understand when they say the word bitch like it's a bad thing. Of course, look who we are dealing with. Since Vasco went on maternity leave, I'm still the bravest officer on this shift, and I'm the only one who has to squat to pee, though we all wonder about Seymour. In most situations, they send me in first, and quite frankly, I wouldn't have it any other way. They all just slow me down anyway, so that's probably why they give me such a wide berth when the shit hits the fan. Even my own partner, Officer Fernandez, he can be a little too emotional and clingy at times. I hate to admit it that I have to rely on him sometimes because honestly, I find him to be a bit weak. His heart is in the right place, but he can be overly cautious, and most of the times he is worrying about me when he should be dealing with the situation at hand. At other times, I honestly wonder if he has left his balls back in the squad car. Take last Friday night. Right around 2300, we got a call to be on the lookout for a white, possibly Latin male, who was an armed robbery suspect. They described him as 5'8", about 195 pounds, with dark hair. His eyes are brown, and he had gang tats on his neck and hands. It wasn't even 1 minute after the call, and I swear I could smell the perpetrator before I saw him. Yeah, I got it like that. He was right there hiding in the woods, just off the road, and I told Fernandez to stop. "Heidi, calm down," Fernandez implored, and I told him two more times that the perpetrator was right there a second ago and he was getting away. The patrol car door wouldn't open. They never seemed to give us ones where my door will open, and Fernandez started again with the whining. "Heidi, maintain, or you'll wear yourself out." As he opened my door, he said something weird in that foreign tongue, and I wanted to say to him, "We're in America, speak English," but I was already off. The perpetrator thought he could lose us in the woods, but I don't need that much light to see, and I swear I could track the bastard by the trail of fear that he was leaving. He heard me closing in and he took off. Of course, it wasn't going to do him any bit of good, since I know I am the fastest around. If you don't believe me, ask anyone in the department, because I have raced each and every one of them, and of course, I was a winner every time. He made it to the road on the other side of the woods, and he sped up. His fear was propelling him faster. I could hear him huffing and puffing while I wasn't even out of breath. I honestly can't tell you if you heard me before I was almost on him, yet I had anticipated that he was going to do something stupid, just because he was tired. He pulled his gun out, and when he turned around to fire, that's when I pounced on him. He tumbled like a rock going down a cliff, and it seemed like he actually picked up speed on its second revolution off the ground. I knocked the wind out of him, though I wasn't about to take any chances, and I pinned him down. Moments later, Officer Fernandez finally showed, and he was telling me in that old foreign tongue to get off of him. I didn't comply with Fernandez's orders until he told me in English. Later, while I was relaxing by the squad car, Fernandez was talking to the other officers about how it all went down. "Hey, Fernandez, who's in charge, you or her?" Even in the dark, I swear I could see Fernandez blush as he said, "I'm supposed to be, but Heidi does pretty much whatever she wants to do." I can't understand it. How can a German shepherd that was raised in Germany not understand that language? Seymour poked his head into the conversation and said with a poorly disguised disgust, "Maybe it's your accent." "Yeah, I guess. I tell you though, Seymour, she understands English. It's a good thing that she can't speak it or do her own paperwork, or we'd have to let go of officers like you." I'm glad that Fernandez spoke up for me, because I'd hate to have to bite Seymour again. Though I'm not one of those dogs that eats their own shit. Seymour tastes exactly how I'd imagine my own crap would taste.
In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums!
Thank you for listening to The Crime Wave. I'm your host, Seth Harwood. I hope you'll check out the rest of the stories here on Crime Wave and tell your friends about it. It's the CRIMEWAV. Help pass the word, register at our site so that you can participate in the forums and add comments to the episodes. You can email us with questions or comments at info@crimewave.com. Aldo, the mystery dog, and I will get your email and we'll get back to you right quick. You can also call the K7 line, 206-350-4998, to leave comments or feedback. And if you leave a great message, we'll even play it at the end of a show. So drop a line, hop on the website, visit often, spread the word, and thank you for stopping by The Crime Wave.
Get trusted.